Chapter 38. Isabel stood at attention. She needed to stand up straight for roll call. If she gave in to her dizziness and toppled over, they would whip her, or worse. No, it wasn't roll call. She was in Paris now, in a hospital room. She was waiting for something, for someone. Micheline had gone to speak to the Red Cross workers and journalists gathered in the lobby. Isabel was supposed to wait here. The door opened.
"Isabel," Micheline said in a scolding tone, "you shouldn't be standing."
"I'm afraid I'll die if I lie down," Isabel said. Or maybe she thought the words. Like Isabel, Micheline was thin as a matchstick, with hip bones that showed like knuckles beneath her shapeless dress. She was almost entirely bald. Only tufts of hair grew here and there. And she had no eyebrows. The skin at her neck and along her arms was riddled with oozing open sores.
"Come," Micheline said.
She led her out of the room, through the strange crowd of silent, shuffling, rag-dressed returnees, and the loud, watery-eyed family members in search of loved ones, past the journalists who asked questions. She steered her gently to a quieter room, where other camp survivors sat slumped in chairs. Isabel sat down in a chair and dutifully put her hands in her lap. Her lungs ached and burned with every breath she drew, and a headache pounded inside her skull.
"It's time for you to go home," Micheline said.
Isabel looked up, blank and bleary-eyed.
"Do you want me to travel with you?"
She blinked slowly, trying to think. Her headache was blinding in its intensity.
"Where am I going?"
"Carrevaux. You're going to see your sister. She's waiting for you."
"She is?" "Your train leaves in 40 minutes. Mine leaves in an hour."
"How do we go back?" Isabel dared to ask. Her voice was barely above a whisper.
"We are the lucky ones," Micheline said, and Isabel nodded.
Micheline helped Isabel stand. Together they limped to the hospital's back door, where a row of automobiles and Red Cross lorries waited to transport survivors to the train station. As they waited their turn, they stood together, tucked close as they'd done so often in the past year, in appel lines, in cattle cars, in food queues. A bright-faced young woman in a Red Cross uniform came into the room carrying a clipboard.
"Rossignol?"
Isabel lifted her hot, sweaty hands and cupped Micheline's wrinkled, grayed face.
"I loved you, Micheline Babineau," she said softly,
and kissed the older woman's dry lips.
"Don't talk about yourself in the past tense."
"But I am past tense. The girl I was."
"She's not gone, Isabel. She's sick, and she's been treated badly, but she can't be gone. She had the heart of a lion."
"Now you're speaking in the past tense."
Honestly, Isabel couldn't remember that girl at all, the one who'd jumped into the resistance with barely a thought, the girl who'd recklessly brought an airman into her father's apartment and foolishly brought another one into her sister's barn, the girl who had hiked across the Pyrenees and fallen in love during the exodus from Paris.
"We made it," Micheline said.
Isabel had heard those words often in the past week. "We made it." When the Americans had arrived to liberate the camp, those three words had been on every prisoner's lips. Isabel had felt relief then. After all of it, the beatings, the cold, the degradation, the disease, the forced march through the snow, she had survived. Now, though, she wondered what her life could possibly be. She couldn't go back to who she'd been, but how could she go forward? She gave Micheline a last wave goodbye and climbed into the Red Cross vehicle. Later, on the train, she pretended not to notice how people stared at her. She tried to sit up straight, but she couldn't do it. She slumped sideways, rested her head against the window. She closed her eyes and was asleep in no time, dreaming feverishly of a clattering ride in a cattle car, of babies crying and women trying desperately to soothe them. And then the doors opened and the dogs were waiting. Isabel jolted awake. She was so disoriented, it took her a moment to remember that she was safe. She dabbed at her forehead with the end of her sleeve. Her fever was back. 2 hours later, the train rumbled into Karivo.
I made it.
So why didn't she feel anything? She got to her feet and shuffled painfully from the train. As she stepped down onto the platform, a coughing spasm took over. She bent, hacking and coughing up blood into her hand. When she could breathe again, she straightened, feeling hollowed out and drained, old. Her sister stood at the edge of the platform. She was big with pregnancy and dressed in a faded and patched summer dress. Her strawberry blonde hair was longer now, past her shoulders, and wavy. As she scanned the crowd leaving the train, her gaze went right past Isabel. Isabel raised her bony hand in greeting. Vianne saw her wave and paled.
Isabel!
Vianne cried. Rushing toward her, she cupped Isabel's hollow cheeks in her hands.
Don't get too close. My breath is terrible.
Vianne kissed Isabel's cracked, swollen, dry lips and whispered,
Welcome home, sister.
Home, Isabel repeated the unexpected word. She couldn't bring up any images to go along with it. Her thoughts were so jumbled and her head pounded. Vianne gently put her arms around Isabel and pulled her close. Isabel felt her sister's soft skin and the lemony scent of her hair. She felt her sister stroking her back, just as she'd done when she was a little girl. And Isabel thought,
I made it.
Home.
You're burning up, Vianne said when they were back at Le Jardin,
and Isabel was clean and dry and lying in a warm bed.
I can't seem to get rid of this fever. I will get you some aspirin,
Vianne started to rise.
No, Isabel said. Don't leave me, please. Lie with me.
Vianne climbed into the small bed, afraid that the lightest touch would leave a bruise. She gathered Isabel close with exquisite care.
I'm sorry about Beck. Forgive me,
Isabel said, coughing. She'd waited so long to say it. Imagined this conversation 1,000 times.
For the way I put you and Sophie in danger.
No, Isabel, Vianne said softly.
Forgive me. I failed you at every turn. Starting when Papa left us with Madame Dumas, and when you ran off to Paris, how could I believe your ridiculous story about an affair? That has haunted me.
Vianne leaned toward her.
Can we start over now? Be the sisters Maman wanted us to be.
Isabel fought to stay awake.
I'd like that. I'm so proud of what you did in this war, Isabel.
Isabel's eyes filled with tears.
What about you, Vi?
Vianne looked away.
After Beck, another Nazi billeted here.
A bad one. Did Vianne realize that she touched her belly as she said it? That shame colored her cheeks? Isabel knew instinctively what her sister had endured. Isabel had heard countless stories of women being raped by the soldiers billeted with them.
You know what I learned in the camps?
Vianne looked at her.
What? They couldn't touch my heart. They couldn't change who I was inside. My body, they broke that in the first days. But not my heart, V. Whatever he did, it was to your body. And your body will heal.
She wanted to say more.
Maybe add, I love you.
But a hacking cough overtook her. When it passed, she lay back, spent, breathing shallow, ragged breaths. Vianne leaned closer, pressed a cool, wet rag to her fevered forehead. Isabel stared at the blood on the quilt, remembering the end days of her mother's life. There had been such blood then, too. She looked at Vianne and saw that her sister was remembering it, too. Isabel woke on a wooden floor. She was freezing and on fire at the same time, shivering and sweating. She heard nothing. No rats or cockroaches scurrying across the floor. No water bleeding through the wall cracks, turning to fat slugs of ice. No coughing or crying. She sat up slowly, wincing at every movement, no matter how fractional. Everything hurt. Her bones, her skin, her head, her chest. She had no muscles left to hurt, but her joints and ligaments ached. She heard a loud rat-a-tat-tat, gunfire. She covered her head and scurried into the corner, crouching low. No. She was at Le Jardin, not Ravensbrook. That sound was rain hitting the roof. She got slowly to her feet, feeling dizzy. How long had she been here? 4 days? 5? She limped to the nightstand, where a porcelain pitcher sat beside a bowl of tepid water. She washed her hands and splashed water on her face, and then dressed in the clothes Vianne had laid out for her. A dress that had belonged to Sophie when she was 10 years old, and bagged on Isabel. She began the long, slow journey down the stairs. The front door was open. Outside, the apple trees were blurred by a falling rain. Isabel went to the doorway, breathing in the sweet air.
"Isabel?" Vianne said,
coming up beside her.
"Let me get you some marrow broth. The doctor says you can drink it."
She nodded absently, letting Vianne pretend that the few tablespoons of broth Isabel's stomach could hold would make a difference. She stepped out into the rain. The world was alive with sound. Birds cawing, church bells ringing, rain thumping on the roof, splashing in puddles. Traffic clogged the narrow, muddy road. Automobiles and lorries and bicyclists, honking and waving, yelling out to one another as people came home. An American lorry rumbled past, full of smiling, fresh-faced soldiers who waved at passers-by. At the sight of them, Isabel remembered Vianne telling her that Hitler had killed himself and Berlin had been surrounded and would fall soon. Was that true? Was the war over? She didn't know, couldn't remember. Her mind was such a mess these days. Isabel limped out to the road, realizing too late that she was barefoot. She would get beaten for losing her shoes, but she kept going. Shivering, coughing, plastered by rain, she walked past the bombed-out airfield, taken over by Allied troops now.
"Isabel!"
She turned, coughing hard, spitting blood into her hand. She was trembling now with cold, shivering. Her dress was soaking wet.
"What are you doing out here?" Vianne said. "And where are your shoes? You have typhus and pneumonia, and you're out in the rain."
Vianne took off her coat and wrapped it around Isabel's shoulder.
"Is the war over? We talked about this last night, remember?"
Rain blurred Isabel's vision, fell in streaks down her back. She drew in a wet, shuddering breath and felt tears sting her eyes.
"Don't cry."
She knew that was important, but she didn't remember why.
"Isabel, you're sick. Gaetan promised to find me after the war was over," she whispered. "I need to get to Paris so he can find me. If he came looking for you, he'd come to the house."
Isabel didn't understand. She shook her head.
"He's been here, remember? After tour. He brought you home." "My nightingale. I got you home." "Oh. He won't think I'm pretty anymore."
Isabel tried to smile, but she knew it was a failure. Vianne put an arm around Isabel and gently turned her around.
We will go and write him a letter.
I don't know where to send it,
Isabel said, leaning against her sister, shivering with cold and fire. How did she make it home? She wasn't sure. She vaguely remembered Antoine carrying her up the stairs, kissing her forehead, and Sophie bringing her some hot broth. But she must have fallen asleep at some point, because the next thing she knew, night had fallen. Vianne sat sleeping in a chair beneath the window. Isabel coughed. Vianne was on her feet in an instant, fixing the pillows behind Isabel, propping her up. She dunked a cloth in the water at the bedside, wrung out the excess, and pressed it to Isabel's forehead.
You want some marrow broth?
God, no.
You're not eating anything.
I can't keep it down.
Vianne reached for the chair and dragged it close to the bed. Vianne touched Isabel's hot, wet cheek and gazed into her sunken eyes.
I have something for you.
Vianne got up from her chair and left the room. Moments later, she was back with a yellowed envelope. She handed it to Isabel.
This is for us, from Papa. He came by here on his way to see you in Giraud.
He did?
Did he tell you that he was going to turn himself in to save me?
Vianne nodded and handed Isabel the letter. The letters of her name blurred and elongated on the page. Malnutrition had ruined her eyesight.
Can you read it to me?
Vianne unsealed the envelope and withdrew the letter and began to read.
Isabel and Vianne, what I do now, I do without misgiving. My regret is not for my death, but for my life. I am sorry I was no father to you. I could make excuses. I was ruined by the war. I drank too much. I couldn't go on without your maman. But none of that matters. Isabel, I remember the first time you ran away to be with me. You made it all the way to Paris on your own. Everything about you said, love me. And when I saw you on that platform needing me, I turned away. How could I not see that you and Vianne were a gift? Had I only reached out, forgive me, my daughters, for all of it, and know that as I say goodbye, I loved you both with all of my damaged heart.
Isabel closed her eyes and lay back into the pillows. All of her life, she'd waited for those words. His love. And now all she felt was loss. They hadn't loved each other enough in the time they had, and then time ran out.
Hold Sophie and Antoine and your new baby close, Vianne. Love is such a slippery thing.
Don't do that, Vianne said.
What?
Say goodbye. You'll get strong and healthy, and you'll find Gaetan, and you'll get married, and be there when this baby of mine is born.
Isabel sighed and closed her eyes.
What a pretty future that would be.
A week later, Isabel sat in a chair in the backyard, wrapped in two blankets and an eiderdown comforter. The early May sun blazed down on her, and still she was trembling with cold. Sophie sat in the grass at her feet, reading her a story. Her niece tried to use a different voice for each character, and sometimes, even as bad as Isabel felt, as much as her bones felt too heavy for her skin to bear, she found herself smiling, even laughing. Antoine was somewhere, trying to build a cradle out of whatever scraps of wood Vianne hadn't burned during the war. It was obvious to everyone that Vianne would be going into labor soon. She moved slowly and seemed always to have a hand pressed to the small of her back. With closed eyes, Isabel savored the beautiful commonness of the day. In the distance, a church bell pealed. Bells had been ringing constantly in the past week to herald the war's end. Sophie's voice stopped abruptly in the middle of a sentence.
Isabel thought she said, "Keep reading,"
but she wasn't sure. She heard her sister say,
"Isabel,
in a tone of voice that meant something. Isabel looked up. Vianne stood there, flour streaking her pale, freckled face and dusting her apron, her reddish hair bound by a frayed turban.
"Someone is here to see you. Tell the doctor I'm fine."
"It's not the doctor."
Vianne smiled and said, "Gaetan is here."
Isabel felt as if her heart might burst through the paper walls of her chest. She tried to stand and fell back to the chair in a heap. Vianne helped her to her feet, but once she was standing, she couldn't move. How could she look at him? She was a bald, eyebrowless skeleton, with some of her teeth gone and most of her fingernails missing. She touched her head, realizing an awkward moment too late that she had no hair to tuck behind her ear. Vianne kissed her cheek.
"You're beautiful," she said.
Isabel turned slowly, and there he was, standing in the open doorway. She saw how bad he looked, the weight and hair and vibrancy he'd lost. But none of it mattered. He was here. He limped toward her and took her in his arms. She brought her shaking hands up and put her arms around him. For the first time in days, weeks, a year, her heart was a reliable thing, pumping with life. When he drew back, he stared down at her, and the love in his eyes burned away everything bad. It was just them again, Gaetan and Isabel, somehow falling in love in a world at war.
"You're as beautiful as I remember," he said.
And she actually laughed, and then she cried. She wiped her eyes, feeling foolish, but tears kept streaming down her face. She was crying for all of it at last, for the pain and loss and fear and anger, for the war and what it had done to her and to all of them, for the knowledge of evil she could never shake, for the horror of where she'd been and what she'd done to survive.
"Don't cry."
How could she not? They should have had a lifetime to share truths and secrets, to get to know each other.
"I love you," she whispered,
remembering that time so long ago when she'd said it to him before. She'd been so young and shiny then.
"I love you too," he said,
his voice breaking.
"I did from the first minute I saw you. I thought I was protecting you by not telling you. If I'd known."
How fragile life was. How fragile they were. Love. It was the beginning and end of everything. The foundation and the ceiling and the air in between. It didn't matter that she was broken and ugly and sick. He loved her and she loved him. All her life she had waited, longed for, people to love her. But now she saw what really mattered. She had known love, been blessed by it. Papa, Maman, Sophie, Antoine, Micheline, Anouk, Henri, Gaetan, Vianne. She looked past Gaetan to her sister, the other half of her. She remembered Maman telling them that someday they would be best friends. That time would stitch their lives together. Vianne nodded, crying now too, her hand on her extended belly.
"Don't forget me,"
Isabel thought. She wished she had the strength to say it out loud. Chapter 39. May 7th, 1995. Somewhere over France.
The lights in the airplane cabin come on suddenly. I hear the ding of the announcement system. It tells us that we are beginning our descent into Paris. Julian leans over and adjusts my seat belt, making sure that my seat is in the locked, upright position, that I am safe.
"How does it feel to be landing in Paris again, Mom?"
I don't know what to say. Hours later, the phone beside me rings. I am still more than half asleep when I answer it. Hello?
Hey, Mom. Did you sleep?
I did.
It's 3 o'clock. What time do you want to leave for the reunion?
Let's walk around Paris. I can be ready in an hour.
I'll come by and pick you up.
I ease out of a bed the size of Nebraska and head for the marble everywhere bathroom. A nice hot shower brings me back to myself and wakens me, but it isn't until I am seated at the vanity, staring at my face magnified in the light-rimmed oval mirror, that it hits me. I am home. It doesn't matter that I am an American citizen, that I have spent more of my life in the United States than I did in France. The truth is that none of that matters. I am home. I apply makeup carefully. Then I brush the snow-white hair back from my face, creating a chignon at the nape of my neck, with hands that won't stop trembling. In the mirror, I see an elegant, ancient woman with velvety pleated skin, glossy pale pink lips, and worry in her eyes. It is the best I can do. Pushing back from the mirror, I go to the closet and withdraw the winter white slacks and turtleneck that I have brought with me. It occurs to me that perhaps color would have been a better choice. I wasn't thinking when I packed. I am ready when Julian arrives. He guides me out into the hallway, helping me as if I am blind and disabled, and I let him lead me through the elegant hotel lobby and out into the magic light of Paris in springtime. But when he asks the doorman for a taxi, I insist. We will walk to the reunion. He frowns. But it's in the Ile de la Cité. I wince at his pronunciation, but it is my own fault, really. I see the doorman smile. My son loves maps, I say, and he has never been to Paris before. The man nods.
It's a long way, Mom,
Julien says, coming up to stand beside me.
And you're
old? I can't help smiling. I am also French.
You're wearing heels.
Again, I say, I'm French. Julian turns to the doorman, who lifts his gloved hands and says, C'est la vie, monsieur.
All right, Julian says at last. Let's walk.
I take his arm, and for a glorious moment, as we step out onto the bustling sidewalk arm in arm, I feel like a girl again. Traffic rushes past us, honking and squealing. Boys skateboard up the sidewalk, dodging in and out amid the throngs of tourists and locals out on this brilliant afternoon. The air is full of chestnut blossoms and smells of baking bread, cinnamon, diesel fuel, car exhaust, and baked stone. Smells that will forever remind me of Paris. To my right, I see one of my mother's favorite pâtisseries, and suddenly I remember Maman handing me a butterfly macaron.
Mom?
I smile at him. Come, I say imperiously, leading him into the small shop. There is a long line, and I take my place at the end of it.
I thought you didn't like cookies.
I ignore him and stare at the glass case full of beautifully colored macarons and pain au chocolat. When it is my turn, I buy 2 macarons, 1 coconut, 1 raspberry. I reach into the bag and get the coconut macaron, handing it to Julian. We are outside again, walking when he takes a bite and stops dead.
Wow, he says after a minute. Then, wow.
Again. I smile. Everyone remembers their first taste of Paris. This will be his. When he has licked his fingers and thrown the bag away, he links his arm through mine again. At a pretty little bistro overlooking the Seine, I say, Let's have a glass of wine. It is just past 5 o'clock, the genteel cocktail hour. We take a seat outside, beneath a canopy of flowering chestnut trees. Across the street, along the banks of the river, vendors are set up in green kiosks, selling everything from oil paintings to old Vogue covers to Eiffel Tower keychains. We share a greasy, paper-wrapped cone of frites and sip wine. One glass turns into two, and the afternoon begins to give way to the haze of dusk. I had forgotten how gently time passes in Paris. As lively as the city is, there's a stillness to it, a peace that lures you in. In Paris, with a glass of wine in your hand, you can just be. All along the Seine, street lamps come on, apartment windows turn golden.
It's 7, Julien says,
and I realize that he's been keeping time all along, waiting. He is so American. No sitting idle, forgetting oneself, not for this young man of mine. He has also been letting me settle myself. I nod and watch him pay the check. As we stand, a well-dressed couple, both smoking cigarettes, glides in to take our seats. Julien and I walk arm in arm to the Pont Neuf, the oldest bridge across the Seine. Beyond it is the Île de la Cité, the island that was once the heart of Paris. Notre Dame, with its soaring chalk-colored walls, looks like a giant bird of prey landing, gorgeous wings outstretched. The Seine captures and reflects dots of lamplight along its shores, golden coronas pulled out of shape by the waves.
Magic, Julien says,
and that is precisely true. We walk slowly, crossing over this graceful bridge that was built more than 400 years ago. On the other side, we see a street vendor closing up his portable shop. Julien stops, picks up an antique snow globe. He tilts it, and snow flurries and swirls within the glass, obscuring the delicate gilt Eiffel Tower. I see the tiny white flakes, and I know it's all fake, nothing. But it makes me remember those terrible winters, when we had holes in our shoes and our bodies were wrapped in newsprint and every scrap of clothing we could find.
Mom, you're shaking.
We're late, I say. Julien puts down the antique snow globe and we are off again, bypassing the crowd waiting to enter Notre Dame. The hotel is on a side street behind the cathedral. Next to it is the Hôtel Dieu, the oldest hospital in Paris. I'm afraid, I say, surprising myself with the admission. I can't remember admitting such a thing in years, although it has often been true. 4 months ago, when they told me the cancer was back, fear made me cry in the shower until the water ran cold.
We don't have to go in, he says.
Yes, we do, I say. I put one foot in front of the other until I am in the lobby, where a sign directs us to the ballroom on the 4th floor. When we exit the elevator, I can hear a man speaking through a microphone that amplifies and garbles his voice in equal measure. There is a table out in the hallway with name tags spread out. It reminds me of that old television show, Concentration. Most of the tags are missing, but mine remains. And there is another name I recognize. The tag is below mine. At the sight of it, my heart gives a little seize, knots up. I reach for my own name tag and pick it up. I peel off the back and stick the name tag to my sunken chest. But all the while, I am looking at the other name. I take the second tag and stare down at it.
Madame,
says the woman seated behind the table. She stands, looking flustered.
We've been waiting for you. There's a seat.
I'm fine. I'll stand in the back of the room.
Nonsense!
She takes my arm. I consider resisting, but haven't the will for it just now. She leads me through a large crowd, seated wall to wall in the ballroom on folding chairs, and toward a dais behind which three old women are seated. A young man in a rumpled blue sport coat and khaki pants, American, obviously, is standing at a podium. At my entrance, he stops speaking. The room goes quiet. I feel everyone looking at me. I sidle past the other old women on the dais and take my place at the empty chair next to the speaker. The man at the microphone looks at me and says, "Someone very special is with us tonight." I see Julian at the back of the room, standing against the wall, his arms crossed. He is frowning. No doubt he is wondering why anyone would put me on a dais.
"Would you like to say something?"
I think the man at the podium has asked me this question twice before it registers. The room is so still I can hear chairs squeaking, feet tapping on carpet, women fanning themselves. I want to say, "No, no, not me." But how can I be so cowardly? I get slowly to my feet and walk to the podium. While I'm gathering my thoughts, I glance to my right, at the old women seated at the dais, and see their names. Almadora, Eliane, and Anouk. My fingers clutch the wooden edges of the podium. "My sister, Isabel, was a woman of great passions," I say quietly at first. "Everything she did full speed ahead, no brakes. When she was little, we worried about her constantly. She was always running away from boarding schools and convents and finishing school, sneaking out of windows and onto trains. I thought she was reckless and irresponsible and almost too beautiful to look at. And during the war, she used that against me. She told me that she was running off to Paris to have an affair, and I believed her. I believed her. All these years later, that still breaks my heart a little. I should have known she wasn't following a man, but her beliefs, that she was doing something important. I close my eyes for a moment and remember. Isabel standing with Gaetan, her arms around him, her eyes on me, shining with tears, with love. And then closing her eyes, saying something none of us could hear, taking her last breath in the arms of the man who loved her. Then I saw tragedy in it. Now I see beauty. I remember every nuance of that moment in my backyard, with the branches of the yew tree spread out above our heads and the scent of jasmine in the air. I looked down at the second name tag in my hand. Sophie Mauriac. My beautiful baby girl, who grew into a solemn, thoughtful woman, who stayed near me for the whole of her life, always worrying, fluttering around me like a mama hen. Afraid. She was always just a little afraid of the world, after all that we had lived through, and I hated that. But she knew how to love my Sophie, and when cancer came for her, she wasn't afraid. At the end, I was holding her hand, and she closed her eyes and said, "Tante, there you are. Now soon they will be waiting for me, my sister and my daughter." I tear my gaze away from the name tag and look out at the audience again. They don't care that I'm teary-eyed. "Isabel and my father, Julien Rossignol, and their friends ran the Nightingale escape route. Together, they saved over 117 men." I swallow hard. Isabel and I didn't talk much during the war. She stayed away from me to protect me from the danger of what she was doing,
so I didn't know everything Isabel had done until she came back from Ravensbrook.
I wipe my eyes. Now there is no squeaking chairs, no tapping feet. The audience is utterly still, staring up at me. I see Julian in the back, his handsome face a study in confusion. All of this is news to him. For the first time in his life, he understands the gulf between us, rather than the bridge. I am not simply his mother now, an extension of him. I am a woman in whole, and he doesn't quite know what to make of me. The Isabel who came back from the concentration camp was not the woman who'd survived the bombing at Tours or crossed the Pyrenees. The Isabel who came home was broken and sick. She was unsure of so many things, but not about what she'd done. I look out at the people seated in front of me. On the day before she died, she sat in the shade beside me and held my hand and said, "V, it's enough for me." I said, "What's enough?" And she said, "My life. It's enough." And it was. I know she saved some of the men in this room, but I know that you saved her, too. Isabel Rossignol died both a hero and a woman in love. She couldn't have made a different choice, and all she wanted was to be remembered. So I thank you all for giving her life meaning, for bringing out the very best in her, and for remembering her all these years later. I let go of the podium and step back. The audience surges to their feet, clapping wildly. I see how many of the older people are crying, and it strikes me suddenly. These are the families of the men she saved. Every man saved came home to create a family. More people who owed their lives to a brave girl and her father and their friends. After that, I am sucked into a whirlwind of gratitude and memories and photographs. Everyone in the room wants to thank me personally and tell me how much Isabel and my father meant to them. At some point, Julian settles himself along my side and becomes a bodyguard of sorts. I hear him say, "It looks like we have a lot to talk about." And I nod and keep moving, clinging to his arm. I do my best to be my sister's ambassador, collecting the thanks she deserves. We are almost through the crowd. It is thinning now. People are making their way to the bar for wine. When I hear someone say, "Hello, Vian," in a familiar voice. Even with all the years that have passed, I recognize his eyes.
Gaëtan.
He is shorter than I remember, a little stooped in the shoulders, and his tanned face is deeply creased by both weather and time. His hair is long, almost to his shoulders, and as white as gardenias, but still I would know him anywhere.
"Vian," he says, "I wanted you to meet my daughter."
He reaches back for a classically beautiful young woman wearing a chic black sheath and vibrant pink neck scarf. She comes toward me, smiling as if we are friends.
"I'm Isabel," she says.
I lean heavily into Julien's hand. I wonder if Gaëtan knows what this small remembrance would mean to Isabel. Of course he does. He leans close and kisses each of my cheeks, whispering,
"I loved her all of my life,"
as he draws back. We talk for a few minutes, about nothing really, and then he leaves. Suddenly I am tired, exhausted. I pull free of my son's possessive grip and move past the crowd to the quiet balcony. There I step out into the night.
Notre Dame is lit up, its glow coloring the black waves of the Seine.
I can hear the river lapping against stone and boat lines creaking. Julien comes up beside me.
"So," he says, "your sister, my aunt,
was in a concentration camp in Germany because she helped to create a route to save downed airmen, and this route meant that she hiked across the Pyrenees Mountains?
It is as heroic as he makes it sound.
Why have I never heard anything about all this? And not just from you. Sophie never said a word.
Hell, I didn't even know that people escaped over the mountains or that there was a concentration camp just for women who resisted the Nazis.
Men tell stories, I say. It is the truest, simplest answer to his question. Women get on with it. For us, it was a shadow war. There were no parades for us when it was over, no medals or mentions in history books. We did what we had to during the war. And when it was over, we picked up the pieces and started our lives over. Your sister was as desperate to forget it as I was. Maybe that was another mistake I made, letting her forget. Maybe we should have talked about it.
So Isabel was off saving airmen, and Dad was a prisoner of war, and you were left alone with Sophie.
I know he is seeing me differently already, wondering how much he doesn't know.
What did you do in the war, Mom?
I survived, I say quietly. At the admission, I miss my daughter almost more than I can bear, because the truth of it is that we survived, together. Against all odds.
That couldn't have been easy.
It wasn't. The admission slips out, surprising me. And suddenly we are looking at each other, mother and son. He is giving me his surgeon's look that misses nothing. Not my newest wrinkles or the way my heart is beating a little too fast, or the pulse that pumps in the hollow of my throat. He touches my cheek, smiling softly. My boy.
You think the past could change how I feel about you? Really, Mom? Mrs. Moriak?
I am glad for the interruption. It's a question I don't want to answer. I turn to see a handsome young man waiting to talk to me. He is American, but not obviously so. A New Yorker, perhaps, with close-cropped graying hair and designer glasses. He is wearing a fitted black blazer and an expensive white shirt with faded jeans. I step forward, extending my hand. He does the same thing at the same time, and when he does, our eyes meet, and I miss a step. It is just that, a missed step, one among many at my age. But Julian is there to catch me.
Mom?
I stare at the man before me. In him, I can see the boy I loved so deeply and the woman who was my best friend.
Ariel de Champlain,
I say, his name a whisper, a prayer. He takes me in his arms and holds me tightly, and the memories return. When he finally pulls back, we are both crying.
I never forgot you or Sophie, he says. They told me to, and I tried, but I couldn't. I've been looking for you both for years.
I feel that constriction in my heart again. Sophie passed away about 15 years ago.
Ari looks away.
Quietly, he says,
I slept with her stuffed animal for years.
Bebe, I say, remembering.
Ari reaches into his pocket and pulls out the framed photograph of me and Rachel.
My mom gave this to me when I graduated from college.
I stare down at it through tears.
You and Sophie saved my life,
Ari says, matter-of-factly. I hear Julian's intake of breath, and I know what it means.
He has questions now.
Ari is my best friend's son, I say. When Rachel was deported to Auschwitz, I hid him in our home, even though a Nazi billeted with us. It was quite frightening.
Your mother is being modest, Ari says. She rescued 19 Jewish children during the war.
I see the incredulity in my son's eyes, and it makes me smile. Our children see us so imperfectly.
I'm a rossignol, I say quietly. A nightingale in my own way.
A survivor, Ari adds.
Did Dad know? Julian asks.
Your father. I pause, draw in a breath. Your father. And there it is, the secret that made me bury it all. I have spent a lifetime running from it, trying to forget. But now I see what a waste all that was.
Antoine was Julian's father in every way that mattered.
It is not biology that determines fatherhood. It is love. I touch his cheek and gaze up at him.
You brought me back to life, Julian. When I held you, after all that ugliness, I could breathe again. I could love your father again.
I never realized that truth before. Julian brought me back. His birth was a miracle in the midst of despair. He made me and Antoine and Sophie a family again. I named him after the father I learned to love too late, after he was gone. Sophie became the big sister she always wanted to be.
I will tell my son my life story at last. There will be pain in remembering, but there will be joy, too.
You'll tell me everything?
Almost everything, I say with a smile. A Frenchwoman must have her secrets. And I will. I'll keep one secret. I smile at them, my two boys who should have broken me, but somehow saved me, each in his own way. Because of them, I know now what matters, and it is not what I have lost. It is my memories. Wounds heal. Love lasts. We remain.
This is Polly Stone. We hope you've enjoyed The Nightingale, a Macmillan audiobook production from St. Martin's Press. This audiobook was produced and directed by Lisa Bainey, executive producer Laura Wilson. Text copyright 2015 by Kristen Hanna. Production copyright 2015 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.